We know that just before 7 p.m, the day after Jamal has fallen in front of the Tunobana, Ahmed, the oldest brother, is standing in the living room by the big windows, 4 stories up. Faria comes over to him. There's a brief exchange, according to the middle brother, and then, out of the blue, she goes crazy. She throws herself at Ahmed and pushes him out the window. Why? Because he tells her that Jamal is dead.
That sounds likely.
I agree. But does she also discover something else? Something that gets her to take out her rage and despair specifically on her brother? And above all, why doesn't she talk to the police? She had everything to gain by telling them what happened, yet she clams up throughout her questioning and during the trial.
Like Lisbeth.
A bit like Lisbeth, but different. Faria withdraws into her wordless grief. She refuses to take any notice of the world around her and answers her accusers with a stony silence.
I can see why Lisbeth doesn't like people messing with that girl, Blomqvist said.
I agree. And that worries me.
Has Lisbeth had access to a computer at Floodbury?
No, absolutely not, Giannini said. They're inflexible on that. No computers, no mobiles. All visitors are meticulously searched. Why do you ask?
I get the feeling that while she's been in there, Lisbeth has discovered something more about her childhood. She might have heard it from Holger.
You'll have to ask him. Remind me, when are you seeing him?
At 9.
He's been trying to get in touch with me.
So you said.
I tried to call him today, but there was something wrong with his phones.
His phones, plural?
I called both mobile and landline. Neither was working.
What time did you call? Blomqvist said.
At about 1.
Blomqvist got to his feet and, with a distracted air, said, Will you pick up the tab, Annika? I think I need to go. He vanished down into the Zinkensdamm Tunnelbana station. Through what seemed like a gathering fog, Palmgren saw how the woman picked up his mobile and the documents about Salander from the bedside table and put them in her doctor's bag. He could hear her rummaging around in his desk drawers, but he could not move. He was falling through a black ocean, and for a moment he thought he might be lucky enough to sink forever into oblivion. Instead, he was shaken by a spasm of panic, as if the air around him had been poisoned. His body arched. He could not breathe. The ocean closed over him again. He drifted down towards the bottom and thought it was all over, yet he became dimly aware of some presence. A man, somebody familiar, was pulling at his nightshirt and tearing the patches off his back, and then Palmgren forgot everything else. He concentrated as hard as he could, and fought desperately the way a deep-sea diver does when trying to reach the surface before it is too late. Considering all the poison in his body and his enfeebled breathing, that was an amazing achievement. He opened his eyes and managed 5 words, which should ideally have been 6, but were the start of an important message.
Talk to...
Who?
Who?
The man shouted.
To Hilda von...
Blomqvist had come running up the stairs to find the front door wide open. As soon as he set foot in the apartment and was hit by the stifling, stale air, he knew that something was badly wrong. He ignored the litter of documents, scattered on the hall floor, and burst into the bedroom. Palmgren lay on his bed in a contorted position. His right hand was close to his throat, and his fingers were cramped and splayed. His face was ashen, his mouth fixed in a gaping, desperate grimace. The old man looked as though he had died a terrible death, and Blomqvist stood there for an instant, bewildered and in shock. Then there was something. He thought he could see a gleam deep in the eyes, which galvanized him into calling the emergency services. He shook Palmgren and inspected his chest and mouth. Clearly the old man was having trouble breathing, so he at once pinched his nostrils tight and breathed heavily and steadily into his airways. Palmgren's lips were blue and cold, and for a long time Blomqvist thought he was doing no good. Even so, he refused to give up. He would have kept going until the ambulance arrived if the old man had not suddenly given a start and waved one of his hands. At first Blomqvist thought it was a spasm, an instinctive movement as life and strength returned, and he felt a glimmer of hope. Then he wondered. Was the hand trying to tell him something? It was gesticulating towards Palmgren's back, and Blomqvist yanked off his nightshirt. He discovered 2 patches, which he tore off without hesitating. What was written on them? What the hell did it say? He tried to focus. Active substance fentanyl. What was that? He looked at Palmgren and wondered for a moment where to begin. He took out his mobile and Googled. It said,
Fentanyl is a powerful synthetic opioid analgesic that is similar to morphine but 50 to 100 times more potent. Normal side effects are respiratory depression, cramp in the muscles of the windpipe. Naloxone is an antidote.
Shit! Shit!
He rang emergency services again, gave his name and said he had called moments earlier. He almost shouted.
You've got to bring naloxone, do you hear? He has to have naloxone injections. He's in deep respiratory distress.
He hung up and was about to go on with his artificial respiration when Palmgren tried to say something.
Later, Blomqvist hushed him. Save his strength.
Palmgren shook his head and gave a hoarse whisper. It was impossible to understand what he was saying. It was a low, almost soundless croaking, terrible to hear. Blomqvist bit his lip and was about to start breathing more air into the old man when he thought he could make out something he was saying. Two words.
Talk to.
Who? Who?
And then with his last reserves of strength, Palmgren wheezed something which sounded like...
Hilda from...
Hilda from what?
To Hilda von...
It had to be something important. Something crucial.
Von who? Von Essen? Von Rosen?
Palmgren gave him a desperate look. Then something happened to his eyes. The pupils widened. His jaw dropped open. He looked dramatically worse. And Blomqvist did everything in his power. Artificial respiration, CPR, everything. And for a split second he thought it was working again. Palmgren raised his hand. There was something majestic about the movement. The crooked fingers clenched, a knotted fist held up as if in defiance a couple of inches above the bed. Then the hand fell back against the blanket. Palmgren's eyelids opened wide. His body convulsed, and then it was all over. Blomqvist could tell. He knew in his heart of hearts, but he did not let up. He pressed down harder on Palmgren's chest and steadily blew air into his windpipe. He gently slapped his cheeks and yelled at him to live and breathe. Eventually he had to accept that it was to no avail. There was no pulse, no breathing, nothing. He banged his fist on the bedside table so hard that the pillbox fell off and pills rolled all over the floor. He looked out towards Liljeholmen. It was 8:43 p.m. Outside in the square a couple of teenage girls were laughing. There was a faint smell of cooking in the air. Blomqvist closed the old man's eyes, smoothed the covers, and looked at his face. There was nothing positive you could say about any one of his features. They were crooked and twisted and withered. Yet there was a profound dignity there. That's how it seemed to him. It was as if the world had all of a sudden become a little poorer. Blomqvist felt his throat catch, and he thought about Salander and how Palmgren had gone all the way to visit her. He thought of everything and nothing. And then the ambulance crew arrived, two men in their 30s. Blomqvist gave as factual an account of events as he could. He told them about the fentanyl. He said that Palmgren had probably had an overdose, that there could be suspicious circumstances, and that the police should be called. He was met by a resigned indifference which made him want to scream, but he kept his mouth shut and only nodded stiffly when the men laid a sheet over Palmgren and left the body lying on the bed to wait for a doctor to come and issue a death certificate. Blomqvist stayed in the apartment. He picked the pills up off the floor, opened the windows and the balcony door, and sat down in the black armchair next to the bed and tried to think clearly. There was far too much buzzing around in his head. Then he remembered the documents, which had been scattered in a mess on the hall floor when he rushed into the apartment. He went to pick them up and read them while standing by the front door. At first he did not understand the context, but he did spot one name which he latched on to immediately. Peter Teleborian. Teleborian was the psychiatrist who had fabricated the report on Salander after she threw a firebomb at her father when she was 12 years old. It was he who had claimed to want to treat and cure Salander, to restore her to a normal life, but who had, in fact, systematically tormented her day in and day out, strapping her to her bed and subjecting her to extreme psychological torment. Why on earth were there papers about that man lying in Holger Palmgren's hall? A quick look through the documents was enough to tell Blomqvist that there was nothing new. They looked like photocopies of the same grimly dry case notes which later led to Teleborian being found guilty of gross dereliction of duty and stripped of his right to practice medicine. But it was also clear that the pages of the documents, which were not numbered, were not in a complete sequence. Some pages ended in the middle of a sentence, and others began in a different context. Were the missing papers in the apartment? Had they been taken away? Blomqvist considered searching through the drawers and cupboards. He decided not to interfere in the police investigation, which would no doubt ensue, and instead he called Chief Inspector Jan Bublanski to tell him what had happened. Then he rang the maximum security unit at Floodberia Prison. A man answered, identifying himself as Fred. He spoke in an arrogant drawl, and Blomqvist almost lost his temper, especially as he looked over at the bed and saw the contours of Palmgren's body beneath the white sheet. But he mustered all his authority and explained that there had been a death in Salander's family, and at last he was allowed to talk to her. It was a conversation he could have done without. Salander hung up and was escorted by two guards down the long corridor back to her cell. She did not pick up on the deep hostility in the face of one of them, Fred Strummer. She did not take in anything going on around her, and her face betrayed nothing of her emotions. She ignored the question, "Has somebody died?" She didn't even look up. She just walked and heard her own footsteps and breathing and nothing else. And she had no idea why the guards followed her into her cell, except that they wanted to mess with her. Since Benito had been floored, they took every opportunity to poison her life. Now it seemed they wanted to search her cell again, not because they thought they would find anything, but because it was an excellent excuse to turn the place upside down and throw her mattress onto the floor. Perhaps they were hoping for an outburst from her, so that they could have a proper fight. They almost succeeded, but Salander gritted her teeth and did not even look up at them as they left. Afterwards she picked up the mattress, sat on the corner of the bed, and focused on what Blomqvist had said. She thought about the morphine patches he had ripped off Palmgren's back, and the papers that had been lying about on the hall floor, and the words, Hilda von. She concentrated especially hard on them, but it didn't make sense. She stood up and banged her fist on the desk, then kicked the clothes cupboard and the wash basin. For one dizzying second she looked as if she could kill. But then she pulled herself together and tried to focus on one thing at a time. First you find out the truth, then you take revenge. Chapter 10. June 20th. Chief Inspector Bublanski had a tendency to deliver lengthy, philosophical discourses, but just now he said nothing. It was 3:20 p.m. and his team, the murder squad of the Violent Crimes Division, had been working hard all day long. It was stuffy and hot in the meeting room on the fifth floor of police headquarters on Berisgaten. Given his age, Jan Bublanski was afraid of many things, but perhaps he feared the absence of doubt most of all. He was a man of faith who was uncomfortable in the face of convictions too strongly held or oversimplified explanations. He was forever producing counter-arguments and contrary hypotheses. Nothing was so certain that it could not be challenged one more time. While this behavior slowed him down, it also prevented him from making too many mistakes. His goal right now was to persuade his colleagues to come to their senses. He did not know where to begin. In many ways, Bublanski was a lucky man. He had a new woman in his life, Professor Farah Sharif, who, so he said, was more beautiful and intelligent than he deserved. The couple had just moved into a three-bedroom apartment near Nidoriet, and they had acquired a Labrador. They often ate out and went regularly to art exhibitions. But the world had gone mad, in his opinion. Lies and stupidity were more widespread than ever before. Demagogues and psychopaths dominated the political scene, and prejudice and intolerance were poisoning everything, sometimes even penetrating the discussions within his own, otherwise sensible team. Sonia Modig, his closest colleague, was rumoured to be in love, and radiated sunshine. But that simply annoyed Jerka Holmberg and Kurt Svensson, who were constantly interrupting her and arguing with her. When Amanda Flood, the youngest member of the group, sided with Modig, and generally she had clever ideas to contribute, the situation was only exacerbated. Maybe Svensson and Holmberg felt that their positions as senior figures were under threat. Bublanski tried to give them an encouraging smile.
"Basically," Holmberg began.
"Basically is a good start," Bublanski said.
"Basically, I can't see why anyone would go to that much trouble to kill a 90-year-old man," Holmberg said.
"An 89-year-old man." Bublanski corrected him.
"Right, an 89-year-old man who hardly leaves his apartment and who seems to have been at death's door anyway."
"Yet that's what it looks like, doesn't it?
Sonia, can you please sum up what we have so far?"
"There's Luli Magoro," she said. She smiled and looked glowing, and even Bublansky wished that she would tone it down a little, if only to keep the peace.
"Haven't we talked enough about her?" Svensson asked.
"Not yet," Bublansky said rather sharply. "Right now we need to go over everything again, to get an overview."
"It's not just Lulu," Murdoch said. "It's the whole of Sophia Care, the company responsible for looking after Palmgren. Yesterday morning, the people there received a message that Palmgren had been admitted to the ER at Ørsta Hospital with acute hip pain. No one thought to question it. The person who called claimed to be a senior doctor and orthopaedic specialist, and introduced herself as Mona Landin. It turns out to be a fake name, but she seemed perfectly credible and was given information about Palmgren's medications and general condition. After that, all home visits to Palmgren were cancelled. Lulu, who was especially close to him, wanted to visit him in hospital. She tried the switchboard there to find out which ward he was in, but because he wasn't actually there, she got no further. That same afternoon, however, she was contacted by this Mona Landin, who said Holger was in no danger but still under anaesthetic after some minor surgery and was not to be disturbed. Later that evening, Lulu tried calling Palmgren's mobile, and the service had been suspended. Nobody at his service provider, Telia, could explain how that happened. That morning his telephone had quite simply been disconnected, but they did not know who in the system had authorized or carried out the operation. Somebody with the necessary computer skills and the right connections seems to have wanted to isolate Palmgren.
"Why go to such lengths?" Holmberg said.
"Here's one factor worth bearing in mind," Bublansky said. "Remember that Palmgren visited Salander at Flodberia. Since we know there are threats against her, a reasonable hypothesis might be that Palmgren got drawn into her problems. Maybe because he found out something or because he wanted to help. Lulu Magoro told us that she dug out a stack of papers for him on Saturday, and Palmgren read them with great concentration. Apparently he had been given them a few weeks earlier by a woman who'd had some connection to Salander."
"What woman?"
"We don't know yet. Lulu didn't catch her name. And Salander's saying nothing, but we have a lead. As you know, Blomqvist found some papers lying in the hall, either because Palmgren or his attacker dropped them. They appear to be case notes from St. Stefan's Psychiatric Clinic for Children, where Salander was admitted as a girl. Peter Teleborian's name comes up in them."
"That snake."
"That sly bastard, more like," Werdig said.
"Has Teleborian been questioned?"
"Amanda spoke to him today. He's living with his wife and a German shepherd in high style in Amaralsgatan. He said he was sorry to hear about Palmgren, but has no idea what might have happened. He doesn't know anyone called Hilda von something, and he didn't want to say anything more."
"We'll probably have to circle back to him," Bublansky said. "In the meantime, we'll go through the rest of Palmgren's papers and belongings. But go on with Lulu, Sonya."
"She looked after Palmgren's evening care 4 or 5 times a week," Murdoch said. "Each time she would apply a pain-killing patch, Norspan they're called, and the active ingredient is... what's it called again, Yerka?"
"Nice move," Bublansky thought. "Involve them. Make them feel like they can contribute."
"Buprenorphine," Holmberry said. "It's an opioid made from poppies used as a painkiller in geriatric care. It's also present in a drug called Subutex, which is prescribed for heroin addicts."
"Right. Palmgren ordinarily got a modest dose," Murdoch said. "But what Blomqvist tore off his back yesterday was something entirely different. 2 prepared fentanyl activist patches. Together they add up to a lethal amount, isn't that right, Yerka?"
"Would have killed a horse."
"It's amazing Palmgren survived for as long as he did, and he even managed to get out a few words."
"Interesting words, too," Bublansky said.
"They certainly are, though anything said by a heavily drugged man in a situation like that needs to be viewed with a degree of caution. The words were, Hilda von, or rather, talk to Hilda von. According to Blomqvist, Palmgren seemed to want to tell him something important. One can speculate as to whether that is the perpetrator's name. As you know, we have a witness statement that yesterday evening a slim, black-haired woman of indeterminate age, wearing sunglasses, was seen hurrying down the stairs with a brown leather bag. Right now it's impossible to judge how much value we should be attaching to it. Besides, I rather doubt that Palmgren would say, talk to, if he was referring to the person who had just hurt him. It sounds more likely that this Hilda von is somebody with important information. Or else it could be someone completely unconnected, but whose name came into his head at the moment he died."
"Could be, but still.
What do we have on the actual name?
At first it looked promising, Murdig said. The von prefix is associated with aristocracy in Sweden, and that gives us a pretty limited circle. But Hilda is a common name in Germany, too, and there the von can also be a preposition, simply meaning from. Therefore, if we include Germanic names, we're talking about a much larger group. Jan and I agree that we should get a little further in the investigation before we embark on questioning all the aristocratic Hildas from the grandest families in Sweden.
And what are you getting out of Salander?
Svensson said.
Not a lot, unfortunately.
Bloody typical.
Well, yes, I suppose that's fair, Murdig said. But we haven't yet spoken to her ourselves. We've relied on our colleagues in the Örebro force. She's a witness for them in a different case, a serious assault on Beatrice Andersson at Flordberry.
Who the hell was brave enough to attack Benito?
Holmberg burst out.
The warden in the maximum security unit, Alvar Olsson, he says he had no choice. I'll get to that.
I hope he's got bodyguards,
Holmberg said.
Security in the unit has been stepped up, and Benito's being transferred to another prison as soon as she's fit to be moved. Right now she's in hospital in Örebro.
That won't be enough, I can promise you that,
Holmberg said.
Do you have the slightest idea what sort of person Benito is? Have you ever seen the state of her victims? Trust me, she won't give up until Olsen's had his throat cut. Slowly.
Both we and the prison management know the situation is serious, Murdig said, slightly irritated. But we see no acute danger for the time being. May I continue?
Our colleagues in Örebro didn't get much out of Salander, as I said. We have to hope that you, Jan, she trusts you, will do better. All of us, that's right, isn't it, have a feeling that Salander is a key person here. According to Blomqvist, Palmgren was worried about her and told Blomqvist on the phone a day or so ago that he'd done something rash or stupid because of it. And that's interesting. What did he mean? And how rash can an infirm 89-year-old possibly be?
I would suggest we're talking about a phone call or an impetuous search on his computer, Flood said.
I agree, but we're not finding anything helpful. Plus, his mobile seems to have vanished into thin air.
That sounds suspicious, Flood said.
Indeed. And there's something else I think we should talk about.
It's better if you take over here, Jan, Murdig said.
Bublansky squirmed as if he would rather not. Then he took them through the story of Faria Kazi, which he himself had learned that morning.
As you've heard, Salander didn't want to talk to the Örebro police about her meeting with Palmgren, he said. She didn't want to say much about the assault on Benito, either. But there was one thing she did want to discuss, and that was the investigation into the death of Jamal Chowdhury, a refugee from Bangladesh. She thinks it was very badly handled, and I have to say I agree.
What makes you say that?
The haste with which it was determined to be a suicide. If this had been just another case of some poor wretch jumping in front of a Tunnelbana train, I might understand it. But this was no ordinary incident. There was a fatwa against Chowdhury, and you cannot make light of that. There's a small group in Stockholm which has been radicalized through the influence of extremist elements in Bangladesh, and which seems prepared to kill at the drop of a hat. Since Chowdhury first arrived in Sweden, we should have been suspicious if he'd so much as slipped on a banana skin. But then he falls in love with Faria Kazi, whose brothers want to marry her off to a rich Islamist in Dhaka. You can imagine how furious they must have been when Faria ran away into the arms of Chowdhury, of all people. Not only is Chowdhury the man who destroys the family's honour, he's also a religious and political enemy. Then all of a sudden he goes and falls in front of a train. And what do our colleagues do? They write it off as a suicide as easily as they'd investigate a domestic burglary in Vällingby. When in fact there's a long list of strange circumstances surrounding the events. On top of that, what happens the day after Chowdhury's death, Faria Kazi has a fit of rage and shoves her brother Ahmed out through a window in Sikla. I find it very hard to believe that has nothing to do with the incident in the Tunnelbana.
Okay, I get that, and it doesn't sound too good, but in what way is it connected to Palmgren's death? Svensson said.
Maybe it isn't, but still. Faria Kazi ends up in the maximum security unit at Flodberia, with Salander, and, like her, is the target of serious threats. There are major concerns that her brothers will want their revenge, and today we've had confirmation from Seppo that they've been in touch with none other than Benito. The brothers call themselves believers, but they have more in common with Benito than with Muslims in general. And if it's revenge thereafter, Benito is the ideal weapon.
I can imagine, Holmberg said.
It also seems that Benito has taken an interest in both Kazi and Salander.
How do we know that?
From the investigation carried out by the prison into how Benito got her stiletto into the unit. They went through absolutely everything, including the trash in the visitors' section in H Block. A crumpled note was found in one of the waste paper baskets there with some very disturbing information in Benito's handwriting. Not only the address of the school to which Olsen's 9-year-old daughter was moved some months ago, but also about the particulars of Faria's aunt, Fatima, the only one in the family she's still close to. And, most noteworthy, details about people close to Salander. Mikael Blomqvist, a lawyer by the name of Jeremy Macmillan in Gibraltar, no, I still don't know who that is, and Holger Palmgren.
Oh, no. Really? Flood said.
Unfortunately. It feels almost uncanny to see Palmgren's name there and to know it was written before he died. Not only his name, but his address, door code, and telephone number.
Not good, Holmberry said.
No, it's not necessarily linked to his murder, or what we believe to be his murder. But it is striking, isn't it? Blomqvist was walking along Hantverkargaten on Kungsholmen when his mobile rang. It was Sophia Melker at the office. She wanted to know how he was.
So, sir, he answered,
and he thought that was the end of it. Melker was the 8th person that day to call and extend condolences. There was nothing wrong with that, but he would rather be left alone. He wanted to deal with the situation the way he normally dealt with death, through hard work. He had been in Uppsala that morning and read the file for the investigation of the Rosvik finance director, who had been involved in the accidental shooting of psychologist Carl Sager. Now he was on his way to meet Eleanor Hjort, the woman who had been engaged to Sager at the time.
"Thanks, Sophie," he said. "Speak later. I'm going into a meeting now."
"Okay, we can deal with it later."
"Deal with what?"
"Erica asked me to check something for you."
"Oh, yes. Did you find anything?"
"Depends."
"What do you mean, depends?"
"There's nothing untoward in Hermann and Vivica Mannheimer's personal files."
"I'd have been surprised if there had been. I'm more interested in Leo's file. He might have been adopted, or maybe there was something sensitive or out of the ordinary in his background."
"In fact, his documents look neat and tidy. They state clearly that he was born in Vesterled Parish, where his parents lived at the time of his birth. Column 20, headed Adoptive Parents or Children, etc., is blank. There's nothing redacted or declared confidential. Everything seems normal. Each parish he lived in while growing up is neatly listed. There's nothing that stands out at all."
"But didn't you say depends?"
"Let me put it this way. I thought it could be fun to take a look at my own personal file, since I was down at the city archives anyway, so I asked for it and paid the 8 kroner, which I've decided not to claim back from Millennium."
"How very generous of you."
"The thing is, I'm only 3 years older than Leo, but my file looks totally different," she said.
"In what way?"
"It's not as tidy. Reading it makes me feel really old. There's one column, column 19, where dates and other details have been recorded from whenever I moved and was transferred to another parish. I don't know who writes those entries. Civil servants, I would guess. But they're an absolute mess. Sometimes the notes are written by hand. Sometimes they're typed. Some of the information has been stamped in, and then it's not always straight, as if they'd had difficulty lining it up properly. But in Leo's file, it's all perfect. Everything is consistent, filled in on the same kind of machine or computer."
"As if someone had reconstituted it?"
"Well," Sophie said, "if someone else had asked me, or if I just happened to see his file, the thought would never have occurred to me. But you make us all a bit paranoid, you know, Mikael. With you, we smell a rat. So yes, with all that in mind, I wouldn't rule out that the file was rewritten after the fact. What's all this about?"
"I don't know yet. You didn't say who you were, did you, Sophie?"
"I took advantage of my right to remain anonymous, as Erica suggested, and fortunately I'm not a celebrity like you."
"Great. Take care now, and thanks."
He ended the call and looked gloomily over Kungsholm's story. It was a glorious day, which only made things worse. He carried on down to the address he had been given, Nor Melestrand 32, where Carl Sager's former fiancée, Eleanor Hjort, lived with her 15-year-old daughter. These days she was a manager at Bukowski's auction rooms, 52 years old, divorced for 3 years, and active in a number of non-profit organizations. She also coached her daughter's basketball team. Clearly an active woman. Blomqvist looked down towards Lake Mellerin, which was lying windstill. and across to his own apartment on the other side of the water. It was oppressively hot, and he felt sticky and heavy as he keyed in the code and took the lift to the top floor. He rang the doorbell and did not have to wait long. Eleanor Hjort looked surprisingly young. She had short hair, beautiful dark brown eyes, and a small scar just below the hairline. She was dressed in a black jacket and grey trousers, and her home was filled with books and paintings. As she served Blomqvist tea and biscuits, she seemed nervous. The cups and saucers rattled as she set them down on a table between a light blue sofa and matching armchairs. Blomqvist made himself comfortable in one of them, beneath a rather garish oil painting of Venice.
"I must say I'm surprised you should bring up this story again after all these years," she said.
"I do understand, and I'm sorry if I'm opening old wounds, but I would like to know a little more about Carl.
Why is he of interest all of a sudden?"
Blomqvist hesitated and decided to be honest. "I wish I could say. Perhaps there's more to his death than meets the eye. Something feels not quite right."
"What do you mean, more specifically?"
"It's still mostly a gut instinct. I went to Uppsala and read all the witness statements, and there's actually nothing inconsistent or odd about them, except, well, precisely, that there is nothing odd about them. If I've learned anything over the years, it's that the truth is generally a little unexpected or even illogical, since we humans aren't entirely rational. Whereas lies, as a rule, tend to be consistent and comprehensive and often sound like a cliché, especially if the liars aren't very good."
"So the investigation into Carl's death is a cliché," she said. "Is that it?"
"The whole thing hangs together a little too well," Blomqvist said. "There aren't enough inconsistencies and too few details that really stand out."
"Do you have anything to tell me that I don't already know?"
Eleanor Short sounded almost sarcastic. "I could add that the man who was supposed to have fired the shot, Per Felt..." Short interrupted and assured him that she had every respect for his profession and his powers of observation, but when it came to this investigation there was nothing he could teach her.
"I've read through it 100 times, she said. "All the things you're talking about I've felt, like stabs in the back. Don't you think I've shouted and screamed at Hermann and at Alfred Ergren? What are you bastards hiding?" "Of course I did."
"And what answer did you get?"
"Indulgent smiles and kind words. We understand it can't be easy, we're so very sorry. But after a while, when I wouldn't give up, they threatened me. They told me to watch my step. They were powerful men, and my insinuations were lies and slander. And they knew good lawyers and all that. I was too weak and too grief-stricken to keep arguing. Carl had been my life. I was devastated, and I couldn't study or work or cope with the most day-to-day routines."
"I understand."
"But the strange thing was, and it's also the reason that I'm sitting here with you today in spite of it all, who do you think comforted me more than anyone else? More than my father and mother and my sisters and friends?"
"Leo?"
"Exactly. Lovely little Leo. He was as inconsolable as I was. We sat in the house Carl and I shared on Grundvikswegen and wept and ranted against the world and those bloody bastards in the forest. And when I screamed and sobbed, 'There's only half of me now,' he said the same thing. He was only a child. But we were united in our grief."
"Why did Carl matter so much to him?"
"They saw each other every week in Carl's consulting rooms. But there was more to it than that, of course. Leo looked upon Carl not just as a therapist, but also as a friend. Maybe the only person in the whole world who understood him, and for his part, Carl wanted to..."
She trailed off. "What?"
"To help Leo, and to get him to understand that he was an immensely gifted boy with extraordinary potential. And then, of course, I'm not going to pretend this wasn't a factor too, Leo became important for Carl's research, for his doctoral thesis."
"Leo had hyperacusis." Short looked at Blomqvist in surprise and said,
"Yes, that was part of it. Carl wanted to discover whether that contributed to the boy's isolation and whether Leo saw the world differently from the rest of us. But don't think that Carl was being cynical. There was a bond between them which not even I understood."
Blomqvist decided to take a chance. "Leo was adopted, wasn't he?" he said. Eleanor Hjort emptied her cup of tea and glanced out at the balcony to her left.
"Maybe,"
she said. "Why do you say that?"
because sometimes I got the impression that there was something sensitive about his background.
Blomqvist decided to take another gamble.
Did Leo have gypsy heritage?
Fjort looked up, her eyes fixed in concentration.
Funny you should say that, she said.
Why?
Because I remember. Carl invited Leo and me to lunch in Drottningholm.
What happened?
Nothing much, but I remember it all the same. Carl and I were deeply in love, but sometimes it felt as if he was keeping secrets from me, not just professional ones from his therapy work, and that was probably one of the reasons I was so jealous. That lunch was one of those occasions.
One of which occasions?
Leo was upset that someone had called him a gippo, and instead of just coming right out and saying, "What kind of idiot is calling you that?" Carl held forth like a schoolteacher and explained that gippo was a racist term and a relic from dark times. Leo nodded as if he'd heard it all before. Even though he was a child, he already knew about the Romani community and about their oppression, forced sterilizations, lobotomizations, and even ethnic cleansing in some parishes. It felt, somehow, surprising for a boy like him.
And so what happened?
Nothing happened. Not a single damn thing, she said. Carl dismissed it when I asked afterwards. It might have been confidential because of a client-therapist relationship, but given the broader context, I got the feeling he was hiding things from me. That episode still sometimes pricks me like a thorn.
Was it one of Alfred Ugren's boys who called Leo a gippo?
It was Eva, the youngest, the afterthought, the only one who followed in his father's footsteps. Do you know him?
A little, he said. He was nasty, wasn't he?
Seriously nasty.
How come?
I suppose one always wonders. There certainly was rivalry from the early days onwards, not only between the boys, but also between their fathers. As a means to outdo each other, Hermann and Alfred pitted their sons against each other to see who was the cleverer or the more enterprising. Ivar always came first, whenever brawn counted. Leo was best at everything that involved the intellect, and that must have caused a lot of envy. Ivar knew about Leo's hyperacusis, but instead of being considerate about it, he would wake him during the summers in Falsterbo by turning up the stereo to insane levels. Once he bought a bag of balloons, which he inflated and then burst one by one behind Leo's back when he was least expecting it. When Carl heard about it, he took Ivar aside and slapped him. Alfred Ugren went ballistic.
So there was some aggression against Carl in the wider circle around the family?
For sure. But I will say that Leo's parents always stood up for Carl. They knew how important he was to their boy. That's why ultimately I came to terms with, or tried to come to terms with, the idea that the shooting was an accident. Hermann Mannheimer would never have killed his son's best friend.
How did Carl first come into contact with the family?
Through his university. The timing was perfect. Previously, schools had done nothing whatsoever for exceptionally gifted children. Singling them out was seen as being at odds with the Swedish ideal of equality. Schools also lacked the ability to identify and understand them. Many intelligent pupils were so understimulated that they became disruptive and were put in classes which catered to special educational needs. It seems that there was a disproportionately large number of gifted children in psychiatric care. Carl hated that, and he fought for those boys and girls. Just a few years earlier, he'd been called an elitist. Then he started getting recruited onto government committees. He got to know Hermann Mannheimer through his supervisor, Hilda von Canterbourg.
Blomqvist started.
Who is Hilda von Canterbourg?
She was an associate professor on the Faculty of Psychology and academic supervisor to two or three doctoral students,
Fjort said.
She was young, not much older than Carl, and was expected to have a great future ahead of her. That's why it's so tragic that she...
Is she dead?
Not that I know. But she ended up with a bad reputation. I heard that she became an alcoholic.
Why the bad reputation?
For a moment, Hjort seemed unfocused. Then she looked straight into Blomqvist's eyes.
It was after Carl died, so I have no inside knowledge. But my feeling is that it was pretty unfair.
In what way?
I'm sure Hilda was no worse than any male academic with a bit of swagger. I met her a few times with Carl, and she was incredibly charismatic. You just got drawn in by her eyes. Apparently she kept having all sorts of affairs, including with two or three of her students. That wasn't good, but they were all consenting adults, and she was popular and clever and nobody much minded. Not at first. Hilda was just ravenous. Ravenous for life, for new friendships, and for men. She was neither calculating nor evil. She was simply all over the place.
So what happened?
I'm not altogether sure. All I know is that the university administration produced a couple of students who claimed, or rather hinted, somewhat vaguely, that Hilda had sold herself to them. It felt so cheap, as if they could think of nothing better than to make a whore of her. What are you doing?
Without realizing it, Blomqvist had gotten to his feet and was searching on his mobile. I have a Hilda von Canterbourg living on Rutgefuchsgarten. Do you think that's her?
There can't be many with that name. Why are you so interested in her all of a sudden?
Because... Blomqvist trailed off. It's complicated, but you've been very helpful.
Does that mean you're off now?
Yes, I have to move quickly. I have a feeling that... He did not finish that sentence either. Marlin called, sounding at least as agitated as he was. He said he would call her back. He shook Eleanor Hjort's hand, thanked her, and ran down the stairs. Out on the street he called Hilda von Canterbourg. December. 1.5 years earlier. What can be forgiven and what cannot? Leo Mannheimer and Carl Sager had often discussed this. These were questions important to both of them, but in different ways. For the most part, their position was generous. Most things could be forgiven, even Ivar's bullying. For the time being, Leo was reconciled with him. Ivar didn't know any better. He was malicious in the same way that others are shy or unmusical. He had as little understanding of other people's feelings as someone with a tin ear has of tones and melodies. Leo indulged him, and occasionally he would be rewarded by a friendly pat on the shoulder, a look of complicity. Ivar often asked him for advice, maybe out of self-interest, but still. Sometimes he paid him a backhanded compliment.
"You're not so stupid after all, Leo."
Ivar's marriage to Madeleine Bard destroyed all that. It pitched Leo into a hatred which no amount of therapy could cure or check. Nor did he resist it. He welcomed it as a fever, a storm. It was worst at night, or in the small hours. That was when a thirst for revenge pounded in his temples and his heart. He fantasized about shootings and other accidents, social humiliation, sicknesses, hideous skin rashes. He even pricked holes in photographs and used the power of thinking to try to get Eva to fall from balconies and terraces. He teetered on the edge of madness. But nothing came of it, except that Eva became vigilant and anxious and possibly started planning something himself. Time passed, and the situation sometimes got better, sometimes worse. It was snowing and exceptionally cold. His mother was on her deathbed. He sat with her 3 or 4 times a week and tried to be a good, comforting son, but it was not easy. Her illness had not made her any milder. The morphine had peeled off yet another layer of restraint, and on 2 separate occasions she called him weak.
"You have always been a disappointment, Leo," she said.
He did not answer his mother when she was like this, but he did dream of leaving the country for good. He was not seeing many people other than Marlin Frode, who was getting a divorce and was about to leave the firm. Leo never believed that she loved him, but it was nice just to be with her. They helped each other through a difficult time, and they laughed together, even if the anger and fantasies did not disappear even then. At times Leo became genuinely frightened of Eva. He imagined that he was being followed, spied on. He no longer had any illusions. Ivar was capable of just about anything. Leo felt that he too was capable of just about anything. Maybe one day he would hurl himself at Ivar and cause him a terrible injury. Either that, or he would get ambushed. He tried to dismiss it all as paranoia and foolishness, but the feeling would not go away. He kept hearing footsteps behind him and felt eyes on his back. He imagined shadow-like figures in alleyways and on street corners, and a few times in Humlegården he found himself suddenly turning to look. But he never saw anything unusual. On Friday, December 15th, it was snowing harder than ever. The Christmas decorations were sparkling in the streets, and he went home early. He changed into jeans and a woolen sweater and put a glass of red wine on the grand piano. It was a Bösendorfer Imperial with 97 keys. He tuned it himself every Monday. The piano stool was a black leather Janssen, and he sat down and played a new composition, which he began in a Dorian flat mode. At the end of every phrase, landed on the seventh tone, he produced a sound which was both ominous and mournful. He played for a good while and heard nothing else, not even the footsteps in the stairwell. He was deep in concentration. But then he registered something so peculiar that for a while he thought it was a figment of his own heated imagination, the result of his hypersensitive hearing. Yet it really did sound as if someone was accompanying him on a guitar. He stopped playing and went to the front door. He thought about calling out through the mail slot. Instead, he unlocked and opened the door. And then it was as if he had cut himself loose from reality. Chapter 11. June 20th. In the maximum security unit, the prisoners had finished their supper and left the dining hall. Some had headed off to work out. Two or three were smoking and gossiping in the exercise yard. Others were glued to a film, Ocean's 11. The rest were wandering up and down the corridor and the recreation rooms, or talking in hushed voices in each other's cells with the doors wide open. It could have been almost any day. But nothing would ever be the same again. Not only were there more guards than usual, but there was also a ban on visits and telephone calls, and it was hotter and stuffier than before. Richard Fager, the prison governor, had been doing the rounds, and the guards, already affected by the atmosphere among the inmates, became even more apprehensive. The air was vibrating with a feeling of liberation. People walked and smiled with a new sense of freedom. The general hubbub was now lighter and more lively, no longer fraught with fear and anxiety. On the other hand, there was uncertainty and evidence of a power vacuum. It was as if a tyrant had fallen. A few, and Tina Grunlund was one, seemed fearful of being attacked from behind. Everywhere people were discussing what had happened and what would happen next. Even if much of it was myth and hearsay, the prisoners still had more information than the guards. Everyone knew that it was Salander who had smashed Benito's jaw, and they all knew that her life was very much in danger. There were rumours that relatives of Salander had already been murdered, and that the revenge would be terrible, especially because Benito was said to have been disfigured for life. It was common knowledge that there was a price on Faria Kazi's head, and there were whispers that the reward was being put up by rich Islamists, by sheikhs even. They all knew Benito was being transferred to a new prison straight from the hospital as soon as she was fit to be moved, and that major changes were in store. The mere fact that the governor was on the scene suggested as much. Fager was the most detested person in the place, if you discounted the women in C Block who had murdered their own children. But for once the prisoners regarded him not only with hostility, but also with a degree of hope. Who knows? Maybe things would ease up now that Benito was gone. Fager looked at his watch and waved away one of the inmates who came to complain about the heat. Fager was 49 years old and good-looking, but with a blank expression. He was wearing a grey suit, red tie, and polished Alden shoes. Even though prison management tended to dress down to avoid provocation, he did the exact opposite so as to reinforce his authority. Today he regretted it. Sweat ran down his forehead, and he was uncomfortable in his close-fitting jacket. His trousers were sticking to his thighs. He took a call on the intercom. Afterwards, he gave a tight-lipped nod and went up to acting head guard Lindfors and whispered something in her ear. Then he walked off in the direction of cell number 7, where Salander had been in isolation since the previous evening. Salander was at her desk doing some calculations on a particular aspect of so-called Wilson loops, which had become increasingly central to her efforts to formulate loop quantum gravity when Fager and Lindfors walked into her cell. But she saw no reason to look up or interrupt her work. She did not notice that the governor prodded Lindfors, prompting her to announce his arrival.
"The governor is here to talk to you," Lindfors said in a stern voice and with a look of distaste.
Only then did Salander turn. She noted that Fager was brushing at something on his jacket's sleeves, as if fearing that he had already picked up some dirt in the cell. His lips moved almost imperceptibly, and he narrowed his eyes. It looked as if he was trying to suppress a grimace. Clearly he didn't like her, and that suited her just fine. She did not care for him, either.
She had read too many of his emails.
"I've got good news," he said. Salander said nothing. "Good news," he said again. Still she said nothing, and that seemed to irritate Fager. "Are you deaf or something?" he said.
"No." She looked down at the floor.
"Ah, okay. Well, that's good," he said. "Listen, you've got another 9 days to go, but we're going to release you tomorrow morning. You'll be questioned shortly by Chief Inspector Jan Bublanski from Stockholm Police, and we'd like you to be cooperative."
"You don't want me in here any more?"
"It's got nothing to do with what we do or don't want. We have our instructions. And also, the staff have confirmed," Fager seemed to be having difficulty getting the words out, "that you conducted yourself well, and that's enough for an early release."
"I have not conducted myself well," she said.
"Haven't you? I've had reports.
Bullshit window dressing, I'm sure. Like your own reports."
"What do you know about my reports?"
Salander was still looking at the floor, and her answer was matter-of-fact, as if she was reading it out. "I know that they're badly written and wordy. You often use the wrong prepositions, and your style is stilted. But above all, they're ingratiating and ignorant, and sometimes untruthful. You withhold information which you've obviously received. You've persuaded the board of the prison service that the maximum security unit is a great place, and that's a serious matter, Ricard. It's one of the factors that's made Faria Kazi's time here a living hell. It just about cost her life, and that makes me fucking angry."
Fager gaped, and his mouth twitched. The blood drained from his face. But still he managed to clear his throat, and said, incoherently, "What are you saying, girl? What do you mean? Did you see some official documents, then?"
"Some of them may have been official, yes."
Fager hardly seemed conscious of what he was saying.
"You're lying."
"I'm not lying. I've read them, and it's none of your business how." His whole body was shaking.
"You are—"
"What?" Fager did not seem to be able to come up with anything fitting.
"Just remember that the decision to release you can be revoked at any time," he barked instead.
"Go ahead, then. Revoke it. There's only one thing I care about."
Sweat broke out on Fager's upper lip.
"And what might that be?"
he said guardedly. "For Faria Kazi to get support and help and be kept in absolute safety until her lawyer Annika Giannini can get her out of here. After that, she'll need witness protection."
Fager roared.
"You're not in a position to ask for anything!"
"That's where you're wrong. You, on the other hand, shouldn't be in any position at all," she said. "You're a liar and a hypocrite, and you've allowed a gangster to take over the most critical unit in your prison."
"I don't think you know what you're talking about," he spluttered.
"I couldn't care less what you think. I have the proof. All I need to know is what you're going to do about Faria Kazi."
His gaze was unsteady.
"Don't worry. We'll look after her," he said.
He seemed embarrassed, and added ominously,
"You know that Faria Kazi isn't the only person receiving serious threats."
"Get out," she said.
"I'm warning you. I will not tolerate out."
Fager's right hand shook. His lips twitched, and for a second or two he stood as if paralyzed. He clearly wanted to say something more, but instead he turned and ordered Lindfors to lock up. Then he slammed the door shut, and his heavy footsteps resounded in the corridor. Faria Kazi heard them, and thought of Salander. In her mind's eye she kept seeing Salander going on the attack, and Benito crashing to the concrete floor. She could hardly concentrate on anything else. The scene played over and again in her thoughts. Sometimes it triggered associations to the events that had led to her now sitting in prison. She remembered how she had been lying in her room in Sikla a few days after the stolen phone conversation with Jamal, reading poems by Tagore. Bashir had looked in at around 3 p.m. that day and had snarled that girls should not read because it only turns them into whores and heretics, and then he slapped her. But for once she felt neither angry nor humiliated. In fact, she gained strength from that blow. She got up and paced around the apartment, seldom taking her eyes off her youngest brother Khalil. That afternoon she changed her plans, minute by minute. She considered asking Khalil to let her out of the apartment when nobody was looking. She would get him to call the social services, the police, her old school, or he could contact a journalist, or Imam Ferdusi, or their Aunt Fatima. She would tell him that if he did not help her, she would slit her wrists. But she said none of these things. Just before 5 p.m. she looked in her wardrobe.
There was nothing much there except for veils and casual wear. The dresses and skirts had long since been cut up or thrown away, but she still had a pair of jeans and a black blouse. She pulled them on with some sneakers and went into the kitchen, where Bashir was sitting with Ahmed. They glared suspiciously at her before turning away. She wanted to scream and smash every glass and plate in there, but she just stood still and listened as footsteps headed towards the front door. Khalil's footsteps. Then she acted with lightning speed as if she could not quite believe what she was doing, and pulled a kitchen knife out of a drawer, hiding it under her blouse before hurrying out of the kitchen. Khalil was standing at the front door in his blue tracksuit, looking miserable and lost. He must have heard her steps, because he was fumbling nervously with a key in the security lock. Faria was panting. She said,
"You have to let me out, Khalil. I can't live like this. I'd rather kill myself."
Khalil turned and gave her a look of such unhappiness that she recoiled. At the same moment she heard Bashir and Ahmed pushing back their chairs in the kitchen. She drew her knife and said quietly,
"Pretend that I threatened you, Khalil. Do whatever you want. Just let me out."
"They'll kill me," he said. And then she thought it was all over. It was not going to work. That was too high a price to pay. Bashir and Ahmed came closer, and she could also hear voices coming up the stairs. That was it. She was sure she had failed. And yet, his face still a picture of sorrow, Khalil opened the door, and she dropped the knife on the floor and ran. She dodged past her father and Razan out in the corridor and raced down the stairs, and for a while she heard nothing, only her own breathing and her own steps. Then voices came rumbling from above. Heavy, angry feet pounded after her. Now she remembered how it had felt to be actually running away. It had felt so strange. She had not been outside for months. She had hardly moved and was obviously not in any sort of shape, but it felt as if she were being borne along by the autumn winds and the bracing cold. She ran as she had never run before, this way and that, among the houses, along the waterfront at Hammar by Hamnen, and then up again along the streets over the bridge to Ringvegen. There she jumped on a bus which took her to Vasastan, where she kept on running, and once or twice she lost her footing and fell. Her elbows were bleeding by the time she went in through the street entrance at Upplandsgarten and rushed up three flights of stairs. She rang the bell and stood there, and she recalled hearing footsteps inside. She prayed and hoped and closed her eyes. Then the door opened and she was terrified. Jamal Chowdhury was wearing a dressing gown, even though it was the middle of the day, and he was unshaven and tousle-haired and seemed disoriented, almost frightened. For a second she thought she had made a mistake. But Jamal was only shocked. He could hardly take it in.
"Thank God," he said.
Shaking all over, she fell into his arms and would not let him go. He led her into the apartment and closed the door. He, too, had a heavy security lock, but here it made her feel safe. For a long time they did not utter a word. They just lay entwined on the narrow bed, and the hours went by. And then they began to talk, and kiss, and cry, and in the end they made love. Slowly the pressure in her chest eased, the fear ebbed away. She and Chowdhury became one, in a way she had never experienced with anyone. But what she did not know, and would not have wanted to know, was that something was changing at the apartment in Sikla. The family had acquired a new enemy. And that enemy was her brother Khalil. Blomqvist could not understand what Malin was telling him. He was so focused on trying to get hold of Hilda von Kandaburg that he was barely listening. He was in a taxi crossing Vesterbron on his way to Rutger-Fuchsgarten in Skanstuhl. People were sunbathing in the park below. Motorboats cruised out on Riddefjorden.
"Now listen, Mika," she said. "Please concentrate. You're the one who dragged me into this whole mess."
"I know. I'm sorry. I have to pull myself together. Let's take it from the top. Is this thing about Leo sitting and writing something in his office? Is that right?"
"Exactly. There was something odd about it."
"You thought he was writing a will?"
"It wasn't what he was writing. It was how."
"What do you mean?"
"He was writing with his left hand, Mika. Leo was always left-handed. Suddenly I remembered it very clearly. He always wrote with his left hand. He caught apples, oranges, anything at all with his left hand. But now he's right-handed."
"Sounds a bit weird."
"It's true, all the same. Must have been already there in my subconscious, ever since I saw Leo on TV a while back. He was making a PowerPoint presentation and holding the remote in his right hand."
"Sorry, Marlin, but that's not enough to persuade me."
"I'm not done yet. I didn't attach too much importance to it either. I hadn't even really taken it on board. but there was something nagging at me, and so I observed Leo very carefully at Fotografiska. We were quite close towards the end of my time at Alfred Ögren, so I was very familiar with his gestures.
Okay.
The movements were exactly the same when he gave his talk at Fotografiska, only the opposite way round. Like all right-handers, he picked up the water bottle with his right hand, transferred it to his left, and